Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Russia-Ukraine Dialogues. My name is Leon Hartwell. I'm a Sotrov Fellow at LSE Ideas. It is my honor to talk to tune in live from the Radu Democracy Center in Turda in Romania. We established this initiative at LSE Ideas in recognition that the Russia-Ukraine war is one of the most consequential events of our time. And since the February escalation, we decided we needed to have more regular discussions, interdisciplinary discussions about the conflict. These dialogues take place every Tuesday at the same time. At present, Mariupol is close to falling, while fierce fighting is ongoing in Kiev. US President Biden recently stated, "For God's sake, this man cannot remain in power," in reference to Putin, a comment which he later walked back. At the same time, Biden was also very clear, "You, the Russian people, are not our enemy." It represents the fact that not all Russians are for this war, and that the Western world is ready to work with Russia without Putin. Our theme for today is Putin's options. We would like to look at Russia from the perspective of what is happening domestically, which way Putin is moving. We would also like to look at military options for Russia and for Ukraine. And also, we want to focus on the ongoing negotiations. It's my pleasure to introduce our three panelists today. I will first introduce Baroness Catherine Ashton, who has held a number of distinguished positions in her career, including as former Vice President of the European Commission and High Representative of the Union for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy. I'd also like to introduce Dr. Gudrun Persson. She is the Deputy Research Director at the Swedish Defense Research Agency and Associate Professor at the Department of Slavic Studies, Stockholm University. She specializes in Russian foreign policy and military strategy. Then last but not least, it's my honor also to introduce Dr. Natalia Savlyeva. She's a resident fellow at the Future Russia Initiative with the Democratic Resilience Program at the Center for European Policy Analysis in Washington, D.C. Natalia, I'm going to start with you, so if you could unmute for me, please. The conflict between Russia and Ukraine started long before it escalated in February 2022, although it seems like the media tends to create the perception that it only began about a month ago. You've been conducting research on this conflict since 2014. What has been the Russian narrative about the conflict, and how has that narrative about the Russia-Ukraine war changed in recent weeks? Thank you.
Yes, thank you for the question, and I'm very glad to be present here today. So yes, I'm a sociologist and I have been conducting the research on Donbas war before this new war has started. And what is either what is very important to understand is that those two conflicts, the one which started in 2014 and the one which has started in 2022, they are closely connected. But there was a sort of rupture between them. And I believe there was a rupture as well in Russia's strategic thinking and the role Russia saw, the Russian participation in both. So my vision is as following. So in 2014, there was no Putin plan and Russia acting more like replying to what has been going on, and Putin and Russian government, they has been caught. They did not predict what happened in Donbas as well. I mean, because people were mobilized there in response to my Euromaidan mobilization. They had a self-organized referendum. They wanted to join Russia to get independence for the bus. So I don't think that Russia expected all that, right? So, and they responded to this situation. But in summer 2014, when Russia's army joined the fight, the situation has changed and Russia took control over the breakaway territories. And the difference with the situation now is that actually now in 2022, Russia has had a plan. And this plan, I mean, I guess there was several plans, but the intentions were pretty clear. And there was not even like Russia plan, there was like more Putin plan. And this was very much about, I believe that it was very much, the whole this conflict is very much about his own vision of his place in the history and like his own vision of like what's going on in Russia and what's going in the world in general. And we should understand what he said very literally. I mean, and position and Russian position and Putin position now is that Russia is surrounded by enemies. NATO is enemy. The West, Europe and US are enemies. They want to destroy Russia. Russia is a great country and Russia have to restore its greatness. And Russia should defend Donbass. But I mean, like defending Donbass and restore Russian greatness is like two interconnected parts. And Putin want to be the guy who's like this great historical figure who reunite Russian lands and will make Russia great again. So we already heard about that in US too, right? And we can trace this change also in the some basic narratives which has been used both by media, both by official figures, both by Russian citizens to justify the conflicts in 2014 and now. So in 2014, the situation of extreme uncertainty and chaos, and there was a lot of different narratives which existed in media, and there was just several many justifications for this conflict. And those justifications, they were pretty contradictory, right? Some people said, yes, Donbass is Soviet land, so we have to defend them. They fight for justice and equality. The other people said, oh no, we have to restore Imperial Russia and that's Novorossiya land. Like some other people say, no, we have to defend Russia and Russian culture and Russian world from the West. So there was just a lot of narratives, and those narratives was very vivid. And when I was talking with combatants who joined the fight in 2014, that was very visible there. I mean, people, they relied on some sort of common vocabulary, which consisted of those concepts popularized by Russian propaganda and media and opinion leaders, which is Great Patriotic War, fascist, the West, the Russian world, Novorossiya. But their own narratives, that was very personalized. And like those stories themselves, they were different. So they attributed different meanings to what role the Great Patriotic War is playing now, has been playing at that moment, what Novorossiya is, what is Russia and the West, and like what is the conflict between them. So now we actually don't see that sort of inconsistency in narrative. Now we see that there is one narrative and everybody sort of repeated, and this is what Putin said: Russia is surrounded by enemies, NATO is enemies, and Russian world is fighting the West. And what is interesting is that actually we saw that narrative in 2014, like 16 and 17, and this particular narrative, it belonged to a very particular group of people who joined the war. That was mercenaries, basically. It was the people who participated in previous wars on post-Soviet space. They were very nationalistic. They loved the fight. They loved violence. They believed that their vocation is war. And they strongly believe that what was going on in Donbass that time is actually the part of the sort of long-lasting, like 1,000 years, 2,000 years, 3,000 years lasting war between the West and the Russian world. And if Russia would not defend Donbass, Russia will fail. Russia is a state, Russia is a culture, Russia is that like big historical entity. And I guess that tells us a lot now, who are those people around Putin? So whose views is dominating now? Who are those people in Russian elites who make those decisions? Those are people from military, those are people from special services, and they have very like, just very specific way of seeing things around them. So I want to conclude my remarks saying that, so how we see now, we have a lot much more consistency and let's say much more certainty in how people, Putin, Russian media, Russians see this conflict, right? Comparing to this extreme uncertainty in 2014. But that's still, and this is a big change, which I see. But now it's still like how the war will finish is still uncertain.
Thank you, Natalia, and thank you for being part of this panel. Also, you're our first Russian voice on this important discussion, so thank you for that. I would now like to focus on Russia's defense and security options. So, Gudrun, could you please provide us with a brief overview of Russia's defense and security landscape? And with regards to the February escalation of the Russia-Ukraine war, how did we get there? Perhaps you could also touch on John Mearsheimer's argument regarding NATO expansion. Tell us about Putin's ultimate plan with regards to Ukraine. Thank you.
Right, thank you very much. It's great to be here, so thank you for having me. I'll try to be as brief as I can and try to put things into a bit of a context here. And I'd like to start the way I see it with the you know, briefly, simply put, two schools of Russian strategic thought. You know, what makes Russia great? Where one school argues, you know, the imperial legacy, the empire is important. Those traditions, territories are seen as an instrument for the great powerness of Russia and serve as buffer zones to protect Russia proper. And this policy, for instance, is associated with Tsar Nicholas I, whereas the other school says, no, Russia can only be great and fantastic if it concentrates on its own population, infrastructure, education, healthcare. And at the international level, Russia should be strong at the negotiating table, not at the battlefield. And this is not least school of thought associated with Tsar Alexander II's foreign minister, Alexander Gorchakov, who famously said that Russia is not sulking, it's concentrating herself. And this, you know, in the intellectual history goes back to the ever-going discussion between Slavophiles and Westerners. And this is simplified because these lines often coexist and are not mutually exclusive. But at present, the first school of thought, you know, the imperial buffer states, has the upper hand. And Russia keeps demanding a new international security order, where the Vienna Congress of 1815 or Yalta in 1945 are seen as good examples for Russia to follow. And Putin keeps repeating that Russia only has two friends, its army and its fleet, you know, Dayton, allegedly. A saying by Alexander III. Russia is also, or Putin is also, framing this as, you know, just correcting historical injustices. And to my mind, in Europe, if we start opening that Pandora's box, it tends to get very dangerous. And where does it stop? So, having said this, there are a number of contradictions and oddities in this war I'd like to highlight, and future historians can examine them. First, it's not the war that Russia, the Russian armed forces, have been prepared for. They have not planned for it, they have not trained for it. Nor is it a war that the military theorists have been developing concepts around. On the contrary, Russia has for at least 14 years been trying to get away from the ideal of the battlefield, the Battle of Kursk during the Second World War. And secondly, there are way too few soldiers to undertake such a thing as taking the entire Ukraine. Just for comparison, in 1968, and the Soviet Union went into Czechoslovakia, there were 500,000 men for Czechoslovakia, which is a considerably smaller area. It was obvious that the supposedly surgical operation, you know, with airborne forces and special forces, that plan failed. And they were said to take Kyiv in 2 weeks, as indeed did Putin in 2014. He said, we can take Kyiv in 2 weeks. And maybe they could then, but now they definitely can't. The Air Force, furthermore, hasn't been used the way it's trained for. Everyone thought that the airspace would be dominated by Russia, both Russians and the West, but it didn't happen. And finally, there doesn't still seem to be a single field commander in charge in Ukraine. There are operational commanders in the north, south, and east. And the operation is run, obviously, from Moscow, the National Defense Management Center. And the people on the ground, the commanders on the ground, can only communicate with each other, apparently, by using normal telephones, open lines. Now, having said this, at the same time, it's important to remember that war and conflict in Russia is understood as strategic. And temporary setbacks on the battlefield doesn't take away the focus on striving and to achieve the political goals. So we must bear that in mind. So this means what I'm saying here, this is not the armed forces war primarily, it's Putin's war and the security services war. And then I think about the decision to move into Afghanistan in 1979. That decision was taken by three people, Brezhnev, Andropov, and Gromyko. That is Andropov, head of KGB, and Gromyko, the foreign minister. And then they pushed the entire Politburo ahead of them, including the chief of the general staff, Nikolai Makarov, Ugarkov, who argued against going into Afghanistan, but he had no chance. Furthermore, Putin has now put everything on this card, and in that respect has to win the war. And things might get a lot worse. Also tapping into the Russian military theorists debate on whether to go for wars of attrition or wars of annihilation. We could come back to that. Finally, all this, as Natalia hinted, begins at home in Russia. For the past 10 years, we have seen a strong dynamic between inner repression increasingly and outer aggression against the West. Finally, in terms of war termination, I have a few points. To my mind, we're in uncharted territory here, and the uncertainties ahead are formidable. Russia at the moment has not achieved any of its strategic goals. In fact, it's further away from the strategic goals than when the last escalation started on the 24th of February. This means, to my mind, that we're in the beginning of a new chapter in European history. Change must come from inside Russia, and this is a reality whether Putin is there or someone else. And we all know, taking the longer time perspective, that change might come quickly, and it's always more or less unpredictable. But right now, a new barrier is coming down in Europe, and we don't know exactly where that line is going to be. So final words from me to begin with. The situation looks very bleak, but I'm thinking of one of my Russian colleagues who many, many years ago said, Gudrun, you must never forget in the longer time perspective, the repressive totalitarian regimes in Russia, they get shorter and shorter. Ivan the Fourth, the Terrible, 200 years. Peter the Great, 150 years. The Communists, 70 years. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you, Gudrun. So thank you for situating this very important conflict in context, also historical context, military context, and so on. So I appreciate that. I'm now going to turn to Baroness Catherine Ashton. You've had a very distinguished career negotiating and mediating a variety of agreements. With regards to prospects for a peace agreement between Russia and Ukraine, to me, the negotiations look like negotiations for delay, for a certain party at least. But please talk to us about the most salient issues that have been identified by the adversaries. Thank you.
Leon, it's great to be with you all, and especially to be able to listen to Natalia and Gudrun. It's extremely valuable for me, and I've learned already a great deal from both of you. Let me take you back to 2014 and take you to Minsk, where we started discussions with President Putin, at that point with President Poroshenko of Ukraine, hosted by the President of Belarus and supported by the President of Kazakhstan. And we were looking in those early days for a way to try and understand and identify the issues upon which we could look for agreement. Not surprisingly, energy was one. And of course, the situation regarding the future of Ukraine in the context of a sovereign state wanting to make its own decisions about with whom it aligned on what issues. Its desire to look to Europe for greater trade opportunities, economic growth, but also for the kind of regulatory framework, the kind of work that you can do, not at that point necessarily to become a member immediately, but to look for ways in which you can improve the systems that you have. And at the time, we were also concerned in thinking about that, about what Ukraine's relationship with Russia longer term ought to be. Not surprisingly, these were hardly easy conversations, and they went nowhere in particular. We had some useful insights, I think, on both sides, but nonetheless, we were not able to make any substantive difference. And the ensuing years before we get to February 2022, we saw the increased tension, we saw what's happened in the East, and we saw, of course, what's happened in Crimea. So if I fast forward to now and think about negotiation as the way through, let me just say a few kind of perhaps obvious points, but points that I always think are worth making. The first is that the only way this ends eventually is because people sit down round a table, across a table, and actually work out something. There is no doubt that at various points along the way in any negotiation, you see that people are not serious about what they're doing, and it's going to be very important for the negotiators and the hosts of any negotiations to understand what's going on and to be clear about the pressure points that they use, as well as the purposeful way that they're prepared to talk. It's both things. It's two-pronged always. Keep the pressure on. Make sure your allies are with you, keeping that pressure on as well, but always, always looking for a way to stop the fighting, stop people dying and suffering as quickly as is possible. The second point is that you don't make a negotiated settlement with your friends. By definition, this is going to be extremely difficult to do. Extremely difficult because you're staring in the face of people who've committed the kind of activities and crimes that we've seen already, and goodness knows what is yet to come. And yet you have to find a way through it. And that is really, really important. And it's not, to make a third point, going to be about win-lose. Negotiations are not about that. It's about finding a way through where people feel that they can end the conflict. And that's going to be extremely hard to do. But we already see the signs that President Zelensky is interested in trying out ideas. A lot of the things he's saying in his broadcasts about neutrality, about the future of Ukraine with NATO, about the EU, about parts of Ukraine and the relationship to Kyiv and all of that, are sort of, in my view anyway, flying kites to have a look at what reactions he's going to get to see what might be possible. It is always, when you're negotiating, about putting a jigsaw puzzle together. The problem comes that the jigsaw puzzle is made up of pieces, some of which, individual pieces often, are extremely important to different communities, to not only those who are participating in the negotiation, but those who are looking from the outside, or who have a vested interest from a regional perspective or an international perspective in what that outcome will look like. And we have to keep in mind that what matters in this negotiation, as in any other, is that when the jigsaw puzzle is put together, you can see what the picture is. You can see that you found a way through, and you can see that the pieces slot together effectively. If you don't, it's not a complete negotiation. If you don't, or if you get stuck on a particular individual piece, you can find that you can never actually get to the point where the puzzle, where the negotiation is effective and able to resolve the problem. In this case, initially, to stop the fighting, withdraw the troops, and find a way through. The biggest question, once that comes anywhere close, and we're nowhere near to that yet, is also going to be who decides that it's really been done properly? Who are the monitors? Who are the people who are going to ensure that people stick to that? I'll give you an example from the Iran negotiations. We had in that negotiation the International Atomic Energy Authority, whose job it was to tell us that it's been done effectively, that in fact the negotiation had happened and that everybody was sticking to their side of the bargain. In this case, especially and particularly Iran. There's going to be a need to think about that extremely carefully, bearing in mind that one of the consequences of what's happened here is that the institutional frameworks that we have learned to live with and all of us grown up with have been shaken, or in some cases just don't look the same anymore. Russia is not part of many organizations it was part of 3 months ago. It is certainly not going to be contributing in the Security Council on this issue in any way, shape or form. And we're going to have to look at how we're going to develop the systems that are going to be recognizably able to operate and be seen to do a good job. And that may be organizations like the OSCE, where Russia is still, I think, participating, or it may that it has to be a combination. But it's going to be a significant part of the negotiation, unusually, that we're going to have to think about structures that go alongside it. I'll stop there.
Thank you, Catherine. And thank you also for reminding us that again, these negotiations have been going on for some time in a different place, under different conditions. But we've been dealing with this issue for a long time from this perspective. You know the Balkans quite well also from your experience. And as you know, in 92, the Bosnian War escalated, but it was only in October 95 when Richard Holbrooke broke the 35th ceasefire agreement among the warring parties in Bosnia and Herzegovina. All other agreements failed before that. So that ceasefire then set the stage for the Dayton peace process, which eventually ended the war. And to me, the lesson seems to be that it's negotiating an agreement is one thing, but it's quite another thing to broker a peace agreement that will be implemented and sustainable. Now, based on your experience, what are the key issues that a peace agreement between Russia and Ukraine will have to address in order to forge a sustainable peace? And you've already hinted at some of these issues, but maybe you could elaborate on that.
It's a really interesting example to think about Dayton, because as you rightly point out, there is a difference between getting to the point where the fighting stops and the ceasefire happens, and then translating into an implementation plan that's actually going to build a bigger peace in the longer term. And if you look at, for example, the Serbia-Kosovo agreement, which I mediated between the two prime ministers and then later presidents, we still don't see full implementation of that. And it was only ever a first agreement. So I would start from my experience by saying that you're probably looking at a series of agreements that will be done under a broader negotiation. The first of which is stopping the fighting, is actually saying we have agreed that we will stop and we will start talking. And these are the conditions under which we'll do that. Following that, as part of that, but it's a sort of slightly broader picture, are the conditions on which the troops withdraw and how that's going to be managed. You then move on to other things within the broader question of the future of Ukraine that Ukraine feels it's able to say to Russia as part of trying to not only create the peace, but keep the peace. Other things that it's prepared to do. And this is where it's extremely difficult, bearing in mind people have died and are suffering for the unity of their country. You start to raise bigger questions if you're seen to make concessions. And that is always, always an extraordinarily difficult thing to do. President Zelensky has said anything he did, he would put to a referendum. And I think he's trying to show his people that he's not going to do things that they can't live with. But I think he's also recognizing there are things he has to think about. There are two particular bundles that he'll be looking at. One is the future relationship of Ukraine to its region and its neighborhood, whether he looks for some level of neutrality, a word that's being used, whether he commits to not trying to join NATO in the short, medium, and longer term, and whether NATO is prepared to make commitments in the other direction, if you get what I mean. What the relationship with the European Union is going to be, because although people think that's less of a problem, arguably the move towards stronger and greater democracy could be seen by President Putin as a greater risk to Russia than actually moving closer to NATO. And in any event, there's no question that they think of the two as going in hand in hand. All of the former Soviet Union countries that joined the EU have also joined NATO. So as far as Russia is concerned, for many people, the two go hand in hand. They are one and the same, if you like. So there's a lot about the future relationships that he may be able to think about and be able to discuss in return for Russia guaranteeing, and this is where the tricky part comes, that this is not going to recur again. And then you come on to broader and bigger questions like the future of Crimea and whether the future of Crimea is in Russia or Ukraine, the question of the people of Crimea being able to make the decisions about their own future. So we're into, from our perspective, you know, the determination of people and this whole question of self-determination versus the integrity of states and all of that, which, as we know in the UN, has been a challenge in terms of how you define which is dominant at any given moment. Answer, they're not. You just have to work out in the circumstances. And then I think, of course, there is a question of Donbass and this land bridge that's being talked about between them and Crimea, through Mariupol and so on, which has clearly been, judging by the horror that's been inflicted upon Mariupol, a huge issue. So there are issues of land, there are issues of future, but there are bigger questions too about how far the pressure is going to be sustained that's going to make it for Russia important to reach a conclusion. In other words, the answer will not only come because they decide to end the conflict, but it's going to become important to show that the unity of most of the world, not just Europe or the US, but most of the world, in saying this is unacceptable and needs to be reversed and stopped and we need to find a solution, is enough pressure that it actually makes Russia itself decide that there is more to be done for its own domestic future by stopping and ending the conflict. And these things have got to be weighed in the balance, because without the right combination, you still leave Russia, if you like, in a more dominant position. And it can't be a dominance. It's got to be an agreement that all feel they may not love it, but they can certainly live with it into the future. And as I say, as importantly, who is going to say they did it, it's been done properly, who's going to monitor it, and how are we going to reassure citizens of Ukraine when they go home that they're going to be going home forever?
Thank you. Those are great insights, and I'm going to come back to that. You mentioned the domestic issue, so I'm going to turn to Natalia again, if you could unmute, please. Now, domestically in Russia, it seems like the escalation of the Russia-Ukraine war represents a pivotal moment. And to me, the increasing gagging of the media, the silencing of not just the opposition, but people who oppose Putin's actions, even little kids of 7 years old lying flowers outside the Ukrainian embassy in Moscow, you know, who are being detained, you know, seems to be a threat to President Putin. But it's part of this endemic and bigger trend that we're seeing. Now, do you think it would be accurate, Natalia, to state that Russia is starting to transition from an authoritarian regime to a totalitarian regime? And what does that mean in terms of Putin going forward? What are his options?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah, I definitely agree with now we just observe this very fast, just moving up transformation of Russian regime toward much more, I'm not sure about totalitarian, but yeah, it kind of look like that now. So because we have some longer trends, for example, those limitations put on media, foreign agents laws, which limited what NGOs in Russia could do, and actually which just reduced the amount of NGOs acting in Russia in several, like, 6 years. So those tendencies, there was there before. But last 4 weeks and a half, there's sort of just they made all those tendencies moving much faster. And what we see now is a pretty dramatic changes. And I think that I will focus like on just several trends which look really frightening for me. So the first thing is the freedom of information. So as you can see now, like independent media or any media which are opposed the idea of Russian aggression toward Ukraine, and that is somehow can be justified, they just banned now. They cannot continue. So Novaya Gazeta, one of the main medias, it had to stop publishing its materials, and the same as Kommersant, and the same as before many other sources, because they cannot just proceed, because I guess they just frightened directly by the authorities. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that political freedoms and ability to influence like state politics by ordinary Russian people also reduced immensely. So now no protest actions are legal. All people who participate in protest actions, they can go to the prison like pretty fast. And actually before the war and during the war, some laws were, so there was some new laws introduced which make participation in so-called unauthorized actions very dangerous for people. So basically you pay a big amount of fee, and if you were detained two or three times, you can go to jail. The third thing is that the freedom of speech is very limited now, and that's not only about media, that's also about social networks. That's also, so we see that thing with like people cannot call the war. People cannot say that what Russia is doing is the war, because even in social media, they can be just arrested for that. And they can go to jail for 15 years, according to the new laws, because you cannot do that. And you cannot say against anything against Russian the actions of Russian army in Ukraine, because now it's also the violation, because now we have this law. And now it's also, I mean, you can go to prison again. So you just, what you can say about what is going on now in Ukraine is sort of very limited. It's like very limited by these new circumstances. And the fourth thing is, we see now this sort of, and this is much more about like a totalitarian transition, I would say, we see a further atomization of society and destruction of any possibility for collective action. I mean, and that's just the conclusion which is coming from all those tendencies. And I want maybe to give a couple of examples, which I think is just really striking. I mean, for me, it was pretty shocking. So 2 days ago, there was a new law that now in Russian colleges of education, they stopped teaching sociology and world cultures. So for me, that means that just a sort of signal that ordinary people, they should not judge the state. They should not be able, and they don't have actually a right to discuss anyhow state politics, because what states does, that's what it does. And you should only comply with that. So the second thing is, and nobody, I guess, noticed this change. There was a change in a law of about voting. And I guess 2 weeks ago, the new thing was announced that now electronic voting become a thing. So it was they used it a little bit before, but now they can use it all the time during all the elections. And during last elections, electronic voting was the most fraudulent voting procedure. I mean, it's just uncontrollable. You cannot control that. No observers can intervene. And that basically means that in Russia, there is no elections anymore. So it was a problem with elections before, but now you can just put there any results. So I see those tendencies, and they're really, they're just really, really threatening for me. And I think that what, I mean, this is like the direction that society and the state goes. So society shouldn't participate in politics. And if people try to do that, they will be repressed.
Thank you, Natalia. I think it's a really good reminder that this conflict has a massive impact also on Russian citizens, and we should not forget that. So thank you for that. I'm now going to turn to Gudrun again. You know, you've heard what Natalia has said in terms of what's happening domestically in Russia. Now, could you tell us, in terms of the military facts on the ground in Ukraine also for Russia, how do those events impact on the different schools of strategic thought? And does it ultimately matter? And I'm asking that question because in practical terms, as you mentioned earlier, the decision to war was likely a very kind of elite decision. So what do you think is happening on that front?
Well, the brief answer, it doesn't impact at all, because the sort of imperial buffer state school is the only one prevailing. And as I said, war and conflict in general is seen also by military thinkers as strategic. So, you know, temporary setbacks on the battlefield doesn't really change anything. But I'd like to make a few points on what was said. And Baroness Ashton reminded us of EU and the Russian view of EU, and it's been very clear for the past 10 years. I mean, previous to that, EU membership wasn't an issue. NATO membership was perhaps, but not EU membership for surrounding states. But that changed around 2011 and 12, when the EU also was starting to be seen as a sort of a crypto NATO. And it's very clear in all their doctrines and the national security strategy that EU is seen as a hostile force around Russia. And you also mentioned Mersheimer and all that discussion. And as you know, it's an entire academic field. You can build your careers on various schools of thought. From my point of view, it's absolutely clear that this argument that we were promised and then we were let down, it's an instrument in the toolbox for Russia, that as they use history and various other instruments. And in 1990, this meeting and this infamous phrase, "not an inch eastward," by James Baker, it's absolutely clear that NATO was not discussed at all. The Warsaw Pact was still there. It was about German unification. And the promise that was made was that no Western weapons of mass destruction were going east, i.e. no nuclear weapons in Eastern Germany. And that promise was kept. So, and also I thought Natalia had some very important points on the domestic side. And I particularly also, in adding to all the other ominous signs, the speech by Putin on the 16th of March, when he sort of divided the Russian population in traitors and true patriots, you know, sort of playing on the collective fears of Stalin's repression in the 1930s, in order to create, you know, rule by fear. And it leads me to a point that I really think we should think about, at least here in Sweden. The academic world is now opening up for Ukrainian academics who fled and can't work in Ukraine. And I think we should also open up for Russian academics who cannot work in their own country and anymore. And just as a reminder, I think it was yesterday that several academics were banned from the scientific committee within the Security Council in Russia, and those academics represented knowledge about the West. So a further sign of isolation.
Thank you, Gudrun. Let's turn to Baroness Catherine Ashton again. You've heard the other two panelists also talking about what's happening with regards to the domestic environment and on the battlefield, and you know, and obviously this conflict has impacts way beyond Ukraine and Russia also. Now, Britain's foreign minister recently said that sanctions on Russia may be lifted once the war ends, Russia fully leaves Ukraine, and provides guarantees that there will be no further aggression. Now, we also know that Ukraine has been utterly destroyed, and it seems that we need to have a conversation beyond some of the basic issues that have been mentioned by UK's foreign minister. So what additional issues would you say should the international community add to the negotiation agenda before sanctions are lifted, if we get to that conversation? Thank you.
I think what the foreign secretary, who I don't know, but I think what she was saying was this public message sending, you know, that sanctions will be lifted if certain conditions are met, is a way of telling the other side, as it were, the kind of things that you're looking for. Sanctions should always be a means to an end. They're often taken, I'm afraid, as an end, that when you've put on sanctions, you've kind of done the work. Well, you haven't. The sanctions are the method by which you persuade someone, in this case Russia, to change course, to take no further action and to move back from its current course of action. So I think she was signalling to them that the sanctions will remain until these things happen. But you're right, there is a much broader set of questions that go alongside this. First of all, how is Ukraine going to be rebuilt and who's going to provide the resources to do that? It's going to be of enormous significance. We have millions of people who've been displaced. They've been welcomed by many families, communities, countries. But they've also disrupted those families, communities, and countries. So there's a price to be paid, if you like, for the generosity, which people are very willing and quite rightly so to pay. But how do we kind of get back to normality in those circumstances? How do we make sure people can go home safely and securely? And how can we make sure that that we've dealt with all of the issues that need to be dealt with to enable them to do that? Schools have to be rebuilt, education has to start again, jobs have to be found, workplaces have to start again. There's a whole infrastructure that needs to be sorted out. These are big, big questions. In my view, and this is why I said to you, this is a negotiation that will take place in a series. You start with the fundamental, which is to stop the fighting and stop the killing and stop the war. You have to then build in for what happens in terms of getting the troops out and getting the immediate situation to change. And then you have to start building the question about what happens next. Sometimes we stop our negotiations only after phase one or phase two. I've always believed that negotiations often have to be much longer to take time and to have to develop a way of approaching different issues that are then thrown up, not just the immediate issue that's in front of you, because this is about a much broader and longer term set of questions.
Thank you. Those are great points also. I'm going to turn to Natalia, and just for all the speakers, let's keep it very short, then we can do a few questions also from the audience. Natalia, question from the audience. Privately, how do Russian elites, note plural, reconcile NATO encirclement with their heavily disguised wealth being held in the same encircling countries? I also remember that there were a few oligarchs and minigarchs who, for example, kept some of their yachts in Jurmala in Latvia while I lived there. Thank you.
Yeah, well, I don't know. It's difficult to say anything about Russian elites because it seems, I mean, I guess even for me, there was an illusion that there were Russian elites who mattered like before this war started. But now it seems that only the special service, military service elites are matter. So I guess that a lot of Russian elites, they are not very happy with this war. And yes, they're losing their yachts, they're losing their money. And there were several interviews when Russian oligarchs were very critical, not very critical, they were critical about this war. There was like the sort of, they said that this is makes no sense, makes no economic sense. But the thing is that those people, they just cannot influence the situation. So I think, yeah, they're very not happy with the war. They're not worried about this NATO encirclement because they just were pretty good integrated with the European culture and European economics. But that, in a way, that just doesn't matter now. I mean, that's how I see the situation.
Thank you, Natalia. I'm going to turn to Gudrun. We have another question for you. You rightly say that Russia has nowhere near enough troops to occupy Ukraine, let alone roll on into other countries. Does this suggest that they have no intention of doing this, that they have more limited war aims? Thank you.
Well, the speaking point has been consistent throughout. Russia has no intention of occupying Ukraine. At a time, it looked like they had that as a war aim, or at least get in to Kiev and get Zelensky out. Now that failed, and as of today, the Ministry of Defense has said that we are now concentrating on, you know, stabilizing, liberating Donbas. But whatever's the case on the ground, and whether they can achieve that or not, the overall political strategic goal for Putin is to dominate Ukraine some way or the other, politically, economically, militarily. So even if there is a ceasefire and some sort of peace settlement, Putin will continue to press on, because as Natalia said, this is about, you know, restoring the empire somewhat and the Slavic lands, getting reined in, Belarus, Ukraine, northern Kazakhstan.
Thank you, Gudrun. Catherine, I'm going to turn to you again. Gudrun just mentioned that Putin's strategic goal is to, quote unquote, dominate Ukraine. Now, any settlement, says one of our audience members here, will necessarily involve Ukrainian neutrality. Now, knowing what Putin's strategic goal is, if you agree with Gudrun's assessment there, what form of security guarantees could actually work?
It's a really good question, because there was meant to be, under the Budapest Agreement, a security guarantee for Ukraine already. And that's not come to be, not least because Russia was a partner, a participant in that. So that will have to be thought about extremely carefully. What we've seen Russia do in the recent past is what I call the wedge, that President Putin has established, I think, the fact that countries need to be whole and able to make decisions in order to join the EU or to join NATO. And so if you have a country like Moldova with Transnistria, you have Georgia with Abkhazia and South Ossetia, as breakaway or separate parts of the country looking in a different direction. And then you have in Ukraine parts of the country that are not, in Russian terms, part of Ukraine anymore. You start to put these wedges, making it almost a de facto given that those countries can't move forward in the way that they would wish. They have to spend resources and time and energy on those breakaway areas. As importantly, the organizations they seek to join are wary at best of actually taking in a problem. So there is a kind of way of thinking of how Russia might want to try and end this by looking more to what it can do in the Donbass. And indeed, reports today from the US suggest that they're moving troops away from Kyiv and moving them perhaps into other areas, which suggests there is a change of tactic. And I think we'll see more of the wedge as a way of operating.
Thank you. All right, let's very quickly turn to Natalia for another question. Should Putin withdraw his troops from Ukraine as the results from negotiations with Zelensky, as well as the EU's pledge to lift the sanctions? How do you think the domestic audience in Russia will react to that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very good question. So from my opinion, I think that Putin is a sort of trapped by his own vision of the situation and by his promises to Russian public. Because what we see with public opinion now, so I would be a little bit skeptical about the numbers of the support of the war, because like what people support, what exactly people support is a good question. And what I see, so me and my colleagues were conducting interviews and asking people basically, so what do they think about this conflict? And what we see is that people, how Russians who support the war see this conflict. So they believe that this is a necessary war. So this is the sort of least evil solution, right? It is, so first, that war was unavoidable for Russia, because Russia would be involved in this war. Either NATO would attack, Ukraine would attack Russia, or Russia attack Ukraine. So that doesn't matter. That war would happen. So that's the first point. The second point is that this war was necessary, because otherwise this conflict in Donbas would not be ended anyhow. So that's how Russian, like those people who support the war, see this conflict. So that was a necessary thing. Yes, people are dying, that's very bad. Nobody's like, I guess some people, maybe a few people support that, but they say like, no, we don't like that Ukrainians are dying, that we don't like that Ukrainians are killed, but there were no choice. Russia is encircled with enemies, with NATO. The war on Donbas was lasting for 8 years. This war, which is not actually the war, because Russia's intention is not to kill Ukrainians, was inevitable. And they say, at the same time, they say like, well, but we just cannot, Russia cannot now leave those territories without achieving its goals, because otherwise why they're killing those people, why we're losing our economic stability. So the goals of these conflicts announced by Putin, they should be achieved, right? That's the first thing. And yeah, so I think that Putin's options here are a little bit, so Russia cannot just withdraw the troops from Ukraine and say like, guys, sorry, that was a mistake. 5 weeks we're fighting there, now we see no point, there was no point to do that, bye. No, that wouldn't happen. Like Putin should get something from that. Putin cannot just take the troops, because the result of that action would be exactly that those people who now support the war, they will say like, why we even did that? Why we just destroyed Russia for nothing? So yeah, I don't think that those troops can be just simply withdrew.
Thank you. And I know, Catherine, you have to also go. I don't know if you want to give a final word also, and then I'll turn to Gudrun for one more question directed towards her. But given what Natalia just said, Catherine, in terms of Putin has not yet achieved his goals, a lot of peacemaking involves perception among the leaders in terms of what they've achieved, or in terms of looking into the future, in terms of what they're going to lose. So what do we have to do as the international community to keep up the pressure, to make sure we try and do what we can to end, to make this war expensive to him?
I am going to stay and listen to Gudrun, Leon, because it's so interesting. I have a few minutes before my next thing. I wouldn't want to miss this, so I'll be very quick on that. I think it's about continuing the pressure that we've already started, and it's also looking for new ways to do that. And that involves two things. First of all, adding the number of countries that are prepared to put pressure on. It's really important that not only does Russia feel pressure from the expected group of countries, but also from those who it regards as perhaps closer allies and friends. It need not necessarily be pressure in terms of economic sanctions, but the pressure to say to them, you've really got to stop this, this is not acceptable, and so on. That's really important. And the more countries engage in that, the better. And then I think there's finding new ways to creatively add pressure so that as far as possible, you are hurting the right people. It's always incredibly difficult with sanctions because ordinary people get caught up in it. And although that helps them to put pressure on their governments, it also makes their lives more challenging. And we are not in the business of trying to destroy relations with the Russian people, quite the opposite. We want to build those relationships for the future as strong and as fast as we possibly can. So it's about those two things: more pressure that's going to create circumstances that make those in charge, particularly President Putin, think this is not taking me where I want to go. And then also the number of voices that are making the same statements growing in time.
Thank you, Catherine. I like what you said, and I agree. I do think we have to get countries like South Africa involved, for example, to also speak out against this and use the Quad also effectively, you know, to bring in India, for example, you know, into the club and helping to add their voice to this issue. Gudrun, just final words from you. What do you make of Medvedev's statement regarding the use of nuclear weapons? And related to that, what if Putin decides to use chemical or nuclear weapons in Ukraine? How should we respond as the West? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Very, very good question. Regarding Medvedev, he said nothing new. They have published in 2020 the nuclear deterrence policy, Russian was published. And in fact, the clause of, you know, when Russia can use nuclear weapons has been consistent since 2000. So that was nothing new. But here it's important because what we have seen is an increasing threat to use nuclear weapons. Now, it's a difference between threatening with the aim to deter and actual use. You know, we must be able to separate that. And to actually use, you know, should the deterrence fail. And it doesn't even automatically follow. But it requires a presidential decision. And then this decision should be executed by a number of commanders in the command chain. And also before the president makes that decision, he should consult with primarily the general staff, who might persuade him that at this moment it's not very beneficial for Russia to stop using nuclear weapons because they can't escalate at a later stage. So what we are seeing are threats. You know, hands off, do not get involved militarily in any way. And the second part of your question, just remind me, was about, yes, what we should do if they, well, in terms of chemical weapons, Russia has already used chemical weapons in the West with the poisoning of starting with Litvinenko and then Skripals and other mysterious deaths. Again, should Russia use nuclear weapons in Ukraine or elsewhere, again, this is uncharted territory. This is why I emphasize that the uncertainties ahead are formidable, and we should stand on our own two feet and just watch the situation very carefully.
Thank you. And on that bleak note, I'd like to thank all three panelists, or all female panelists, I should point out also, for their excellent contributions. And we have a lot of questions from from our audience members. So definitely we need to follow up on some of the issues that were highlighted, especially with regards to You know, how do we get Putin to the negotiation table? How do we hold him there and make sure that it's not just a ceasefire that he agrees to, but a sustainable agreement that's good for everyone. So on that note, I'd like to thank you again for your contributions. I'd like to remind our audience members also that we've dropped a link in the chat about a charity that was set up by our LSE student union, who have set up a fundraiser for Ukrainian refugees. Please support that if you can. And I'd like to remind everyone that we have these dialogues every Tuesday. You're more than welcome to join us. Thank you, everyone, and goodbye.